I am really grateful to be here. I'm a huge fan of all things Mockingbird, have been for a very long time, and truly, truly grateful to have, you know, been able to be a part of, for the time that I was, be a part of the resurrection of the Mocking cast. So, I'm honored to be here and honored to talk a little bit about kind of my story. Back in 2021, when The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill was being released, the question that I got asked over and over again by listeners and colleagues and people who were sort of adjacent to the story is, why would people stick around in a community like this? You know, you would hear these stories, you'd hear these characters in the podcast who had been a part of the church for many years. They'd seen things, they knew things, they'd seen how the sausage was made, and they knew that it was rotten on the inside. So what was it that would make people stick around for something like this? And the best answer that I heard came from a Mars Hill staffer, one of the people that I've known the longest out of all of them, a guy named Tim Smith. And what he said to me, you know, Tim was there from 1998 to the very, very end. And in fact, I would say that ultimately the moment of accountability for Mark Driscoll came because of something that Tim Smith said in an executive team meeting near the end. But when I asked Tim this question, when I asked why would you stick around, why would you be a part of this for so long, what kept you there, he said, you know, it always felt like we were one good conversation away from making things right. And I think if you've been in ministry in a thriving, certainly thriving on the surface, but struggling underneath context, you know exactly what that means. Because it always feels like, because you have these shared convictions, you have these shared ideas about what it means to be the church and the mission you're a part of, you have this story you're telling yourself about what you're doing and why you're doing it. And you see all the things that are going wrong and you say to yourself, yeah, but man, if we could just fix fill in the blank, if we could just resolve whatever this accountability issue is, or this challenge with this particular leader, or these relationships, if we could solve that, man, we could turn the corner and just nothing would stop us from there. It's an extraordinary sentence because it kind of distills the whole experience of being inside of a toxic ministry culture. Because you don't say that. You don't say we're one conversation away unless you're a part of something that really feels extraordinary, that feels like you've seen the presence of God at work in extraordinary ways. That sentence isn't about Mark Driscoll. It's not about the extraordinary growth. It's not about the internet audience. It's certainly not about the buildings or the capital campaigns or the national recognition or the conferences. It's about this feeling you get when you're inside a community like this. The sense of purpose, the sense of movement. And even more than that, it's about the sense of belonging that you have in a community like Mars Hill. You had a story to be a part of. John Eldridge would have called it an adventure to live. Mark Driscoll called it a mission. And hey, mock it if you will. But you know, the story of the last 150, 200 years of world history is the story of crisis after crisis and war after war and movement after movement that are animated by lonely people who had suddenly found meaning and purpose inside the story a leader was telling. History in that sense, capital H history, is a hell of a drug. And when you had a taste of it, when you feel like you're doing something that really is going to change the world, nothing will substitute for it. So the longer you're in it, the more consuming it becomes. You're not just planting a church, you're reaching the city. Or you're not just reaching the city, you're reaching the world. I know this feeling intimately. In the spring of 1999, my wife and I were part of a group of about a dozen people, maybe a little more, who had suddenly become displaced from the churches we'd grown up in. We were from a couple of different churches. There were a couple of different church crises that sent us all scattered. We were all in our late teens and early 20s, and we didn't know what to do. I'd never heard of church planting. I didn't know it was a thing you could do. I probably would have told you that sounds like a cult. I might have been right. But we just started gathering in a friend's basement. A friend's mom's basement where he was living. And we just started gathering on Wednesday nights and praying together and doing the kinds of things we had done together all through high school. And wondering, okay, well, what comes next, you know? And at the time in Louisville, there were no, like, again, this was kind of before the big church planting boom of the 2000s. There were no church plants. There weren't really any churches with, like, big thriving college ministries in the city of Louisville, even though we've got a bunch of big colleges. What there was Southeast Christian Church, which was one of the largest churches in the country with like 15,000 people. And so the joke every week was, you know, at some point here, we're all going to just say screw it and go join Southeast. But for now, I'll see you next week. And then at some point, a mutual friend, you know, connects us with this church planter. And then this other friend of ours, this guy named Loy Thurman, who's in Baltimore, still doing this kind of ministry today, 25 years later, Loy shows up. And Loy worked for Youth for Christ, and he was working in the hardcore music scene in Louisville, reaching kids for Christ there. And they were seeing all these conversions, and you had all these kids that were pierced out and tattooed. And he's like, I can't bring them to church anywhere, because everywhere they go, they're like, man, everybody hates me here. And so they started coming to this basement. And then we outgrew the basement. We moved into a friend's apartment. And when we were in that friend's apartment, this church planter, we get connected with him. And he's like, I'm going to plant a church in this neighborhood. And we're like, what's church planting? And he explains that. And he says, oh, by the way, I'm Reformed. And we're like, what's Reformed? And he explains that. And we go, oh, that sounds not good, but we just went with it. So we plant this church in the fall of 2000, and I came on staff a couple of months later, and I was technically the music guy, and I was the music guy all the way through, but, you know, in church planting, you cook till the cook shows up, so I kind of did everything off and on over the years, and I ran capital campaigns and small group ministries and the communications ministry, and we saw incredible, extraordinary things happen. 15 years later, we were a church of a little shy of 4,000 people. We had four locations, and I was miserable. I was exhausted. For the 5 years prior to that, starting around 2010, it had been one conflict after another, a steady stream of turnover on the staff. We were all exhausted. Our executive team in particular, we had like four of us that were executive pastors that kind of served as the committee to run the place. We'd turned over at least three times in that five-year period, all of us except for myself and the lead pastor who'd planted the church. And it was just like we just kept repeating this cycle. I felt like I was the host of the show Intervention, because every 6 months I was hosting another intervention with our pastor saying, hey, we got to have this one conversation. We got to fix these things. If we can fix these things, nothing's going to stop us. But we got to fix these things. And I always walked out of that one conversation saying, all right, we did it. We're good. We're moving forward. One day in October 2015, I got called to a meeting with that executive team. I'd been out of town for a couple of weeks on a trip with some friends, and they said, hey, we've been working on kind of a reorg. Now, reorg at that point in the life of the church, it was like a trigger word because we'd been reorged so many times. Like this is, you know, the problem was the org chart. If we fix the org chart, everything else is going to be okay. So I hear reorg and I go, ooh, you know. But they said, we've been working on a reorg while you were out of town. We want to roll it out tomorrow afternoon. And I was like, well, I mean, I'm on the exec team. Like, don't you think I should weigh in on it? And they're like, yeah. That's why we're going to have you come in tomorrow morning. And we'll talk through it. And if you're uncomfortable with it, you know, we'll move on. Or we'll reevaluate. I mean, I should have seen what was coming. But I was like, okay, this sounds great. I come in and they talk about this reorg and they talk decentralization and they talk about all this different stuff. And finally, after a long setup, one of the pastors rolls out this big piece of architectural paper. We probably had like 60, 70 staff at the time. And so the org chart was very, a very complex document. And on this paper, you had, finely written in tiny print with pencil, you had the entire organization laid out. And they're talking, and I have no clue what they're saying, because I'm just looking at this thing and I'm going, my name's not on here. And so finally I mention this point to them, hey, I'm not on here. And they're like, yeah, well, so it's kind of a choose your own adventure thing here. And I was like, well, what does that mean? And they're like, well, I mean, you know, we want to decentralize, blah, 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 blah. But it was obvious what was going on. Now, I had had mentors at that time who for at least 2 years had been telling me, hey, you got to get out of here. You got to move on. This is unhealthy for you. It's bad for your family. It's time to go. But what I don't think they understood and what's hard for people outside the circumstances to understand is that for my life up to that point, this was everything for me. This was my entire career. This was my future. This was where I was going to retire or die serving. I hadn't ever imagined myself somewhere else. So I tried to put the best face on it that I could and tried to see it as an opportunity, and there's an extent to which it was. But that's how I found out that would be the end of my time serving at Sojourn Church. There was a lot of talk about how nothing was in ink. We could explore other options. And so I began scrambling at that point to look at the next stage of my life, to begin to launch a new nonprofit. I had real serious concerns about Christians in a post-Christian world. And again, this is 2015. Like, this was a very different kind of post-Christian world than the current iteration of the post-Christian world we're looking at today. We weren't yet at the point where Christians were using Let's Go Brandon as an applause line in sermons. The big challenges we were facing were things like, should we bake cakes for gay weddings, or should the federal government sue nuns because they don't want to buy birth control? And so I hastily put together this plan and this idea of like, hey, let's figure out how we're going to equip Christians in the marketplace, because very few Christians who actually have like real day jobs consume any Christian media. So let's figure out how we can serve people who are actually facing real religious liberty challenges and you know, serving an evolving, changing world. And that was exciting for a time. You know, again, it's 2015. Trump had come down the escalator, but he was still a punchline. I remember having this conversation with a guy who was a very deeply invested in Republican politics at the time. And I was like, man, it feels like something's going on with this Trump thing. And he's like, I know. He's like, it's just a distraction. Everybody knows it's going to be Rubio, which is just the funniest thing I've ever heard now, right? But then 2016 comes around and everything changes and Trump gets the nomination and it all sounded like a lark. And even then, the people that I was connected to who were sort of in the religious liberty space and the faith and politics space were going, yeah, he's got the nomination, but the guy can't win. Like, this is, you know, this is the third Obama term, blah, 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 blah. And so I just kept going about my business, thinking that the world was exactly the way I understood the world to be. I raised a bunch of money for this nonprofit, and you know, and I said things about Donald Trump while, you know, launching this nonprofit, and through my newsletters and through a couple of podcasts, I said some things about Donald Trump that I thought were very reasonable and normal things to say. Like maybe the Access Hollywood tape exposes something about character and character matters. One of my donors read that newsletter and called me into his office, and he said, "Hey, I don't think I can do this with you." And I was like, "Oh, well, why? What happened?" Because this guy was all in. We had lots of plans. We were going to work with his company on some things, and you know, sort of discipleship and leadership in the marketplace. And he goes, "Well, it's just this election. It just feels like you're abandoning first principles in this election." And I'm like, I don't think that's what's going on here at all, actually. And he does this long pause. And I'm like, look, I understand when Christians are saying, hey, this is a binary, and I vote because of these issues, and I hold my nose and pull the lever. That was where I was at the time. I understand if that's where you're at. I just think these things matter, and we have to talk about them. And he goes, yeah, it's not about that. It's not about holding the nose and pulling the lever. And I go, well, what is it about? And he goes, well, you know, with Trump, and I swear I'm not making this up, because this sounds like something someone would make up. He goes, finally, somebody's going to stand up for the white man. And I had a friend with me in this meeting, a guy who was helping me with the fundraising. And I look over at him, and he's looking at me with this same kind of like, did that just happen? And I'm like, I think that just happened. And we didn't say anything. We just got up and walked out of the room. And I remember stepping outside that day. I was on a busy urban street, and I just felt like gravity was switched off. Like my feet just left the floor. I didn't know what was up or down anymore. None of it made sense. My church was falling apart. There was a leadership crisis after I left. The pastor of that church was forced to go on leave and to start to address some things. And as the months would go by, that would eventually lead to his resignation. And I just found myself asking, what have I been a part of? What have I been committed to all this time? My nonprofit collapsed. The other donors, my kind of core donors, all left because of this newsletter that I'd written, all for the same reasons. And my life went in another direction, and I'm grateful for it. God provided for me. I started this little for-profit studio, and we had great clients like Mockingbird who came along, and they kept my lights on at home and helped me get through what became truly the darkest night of my life, and it lasted for a long time, quite a few years. For my wife and I, it was this season of just profound loneliness, an injustice in this conflict inside our church that I didn't create, and there were consequences that I didn't contribute to, meant that many of our friends were looking at us as though we were somehow the villain in the circumstances. This story, for me, this is the background to my work in the last 4 or 5 years, including the work on the rise and fall of Mars Hill. Our church had been part of Acts 29 for just a brief period of about 3 years. But during that time, I'd gotten to know a number of the folks at Mars Hill, including a few of the voices you heard on that podcast. And I'd always been fascinated by what they experienced. Churches collapse, and when they do, the pastor ends up on the front page of the New York Times, and then maybe a few years later when he comes back and he starts something else new, or you know, maybe when he's at a conference and starts screaming at people about Jezebel spirits and male strippers. If you don't know what that's about, just Google it. It's fascinating. They're always the center of the story. And what I was fascinated by was, well, what happened to these people I knew who were just part of the leadership, and they were there to the end, and why did they stay, and what happened to them and their families? And that's why the podcast is called The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill and not The Rise and Fall of Mark Driscoll. It's why it focuses on their stories so much. But I didn't come here today to talk to you about the rise and fall of Mars Hill. I'm here to talk about me. Maybe we can call this talk the rise and fall of Mike Cosper, or more accurately, the rise and fall, and maybe, just maybe, the resurrection of Mike Cosper. So there I was. I was in zero gravity, and I remained there for several years of American carnage. Somewhere in those years of zero gravity, I ended up on the sofa of a friend of mine named Mike Frazier. Mike was a pastor at the church when I was a teenager, and kind of came to faith. And I played guitar in his worship ministry as a kid. And here we were 30 years or 20 years later, and he sees me. You know, we were on vacation in the town that he now lives, and he sees me, and he asked me the question that he's been asking me for 20 years. He says, how are your spiritual disciplines these days? And I'm kind of like, yeah, they're kind of non-existent. You know, things like prayer are just kind of hard. I don't know how to approach them. Scriptures are really hard. Problem with the scriptures these days, especially the Paul's epistles, is that when I hear them in the voice of this guy that I worked for a really long time. And what I realize is how much they were weaponized against me and other leaders in ways that were really spiritually abusive. So it's really hard. It's hard for me to walk in the door of a church on a regular basis. He sat there for a second, and he did this thing that I've seen him do since the 90s. He took this deep breath, and he closed his eyes, and he said, you know, this, like, this thing. I don't even know how to describe it. But he says, you know, I think you should spend some time with Elijah. And he opened his Bible to 1 Kings, and, you know, he kind of walks through the story of 1 Kings 18, a story we probably, I imagine every one of us in this room knows fairly well. It's Elijah's confrontation with the prophets of Baal. And look, I'm a Baptist, not by choice, but by birth. I think my parents had a little bit of a conflict over it, and Mom won. I think Dad would have chosen for us to be Presbyterians, which seems appropriate in certain ways. But my mother was a Southern Baptist, and so we were Southern Baptists. And so I grew up in churches where, you know, the Elijah's confrontation with the prophets of Baal, it's this big victory story. And the slaughter of the prophets of Baal, which, like, you know, I get that I'm in an Episcopal church. The slaughter was a good thing for us, right, when we were kids. This is great. And I understand why it's a good thing to see it. Because what we miss oftentimes when we read this passage, when we read this story, is how miserable life was in that kingdom for everybody who had been suffering under that cult. It was a death cult. It was a blood and sex cult. It was extortive. The prophets of Baal practiced what we would now call things like human trafficking and sex trafficking and child sacrifice. It was a brutal, horrific world to live in. And so Elijah's defeat of the prophets of Baal, I still see as an unmitigated good thing. And so we end that story, and it's this big victory, and I've been to 1,000 rallies growing up where we tell that story, and it ends with the defeat of the prophets of Baal, and we go, be an Elijah, go out in the world and conquer evil and claim it for God. But we don't go on to read 1 Kings 19, where Elijah basically, you know, quickly finds out, yeah, you defeated the prophets of Baal, but there's this whole other cult over here, and there's hundreds of them, and they report to Jezebel, and now they want to kill you. And so he flees to the desert, and he's miserable. He's going, man, I gave everything to this. And look what it gets me. Like, nothing. We're right back where we started. And so he flees to the desert and he lays down under this broom tree, this incredible symbol that's all through the scriptures. And he just cries out to God for death. He collapses under that broom tree, cries out for death, and I guess this is the part of the Mockingbird conference where someone talks about suicide a little bit. I heard for years that suicide was the most selfish thing that a person could do, and that was certainly how I thought of it, how I talked about it as well. This act of despair that's callous and angry and without concern for the people around you. And as someone who's been on the journey that I've been in for the last 8 years, I can say that I look at it very differently now. I think the best understanding of what happens when a person takes their life was once explained by David Foster Wallace, who said, you gotta think of suicide, and Wallace took his own life. He goes, you gotta think of suicide as being akin to what happens when a 100-story building is on fire and somebody jumps out the window on the 92nd floor. It's not about them falling to their death. It's about the flames and the heat and the smoke that are pouring through that building that are driving them out the window. That's the despair that Elijah is facing. That's why he's crying out for death. And so I was in this place where I could completely resonate with Elijah. I wasn't suicidal in the sense of ideation. I didn't have a plan. I hadn't written notes. But when I am sitting in my friend's living room and he reads this story and he reads this verse where Elijah cries out for death, I go, oh, I totally get that. I totally get that. That was Elijah under the broom tree. And on that night, Savannah, it was the only part of that story that made sense to me. What's so remarkable about that story is that God doesn't end Elijah's life there. And he doesn't lecture him either. He doesn't confront him. He doesn't tell him all the ways that he's wrong. Instead, he lets him sleep. And when he wakes him, he sends an angel, not with a message, not with a job to do, but he sends an angel with food and with water. And then he puts him back to sleep. Back when I was in ministry, in the circles that I was a part of, there was this really heated debate about how do we deal with soul care and mental health. What's the work for doctors and psychologists? What's the work for pastors? And, you know, I don't want to overstate the case, but I think there's something to be said for what we see here, which is that before God could deal with Elijah's cynicism and his loss of faith and loss of hope, let's call it his deconstructing soul, he deals with his weary and exhausted body. Don't take lightly the power of sleep. Richard Foster once said that the most holy thing some people can do is take a nap. And likewise, don't take lightly the power of food. We're dependent creatures. Our bodies need food and water. Some of our bodies don't process folate properly. This is the thing they've figured out in the last few years. It's a huge thing for the treatment of depression. And then some of us need things like SSRIs and beta blockers to handle depression or anxiety. The gifts of God for the people of God. The first thing we might need in the desert is to attend to our bodies. The first thing we might need when we face despair is to attend to our bodies, to our brains, to the ways our bodies are screaming for rest, for nourishment, for healing. And the soul will follow. That cycle repeats for Elijah. He rests, he sleeps, he's fed again. And then when he wakes, it's not over. And in fact, God is going to send him deeper into the desert. It turns out that it's going to get harder before it gets better. So he goes deeper into the desert. For Elijah, this was his moment turns out that it's worse. He's going to end up going deeper. And that night in Savannah, that was when my friend Mike shut the Bible. He didn't take me to the next stage in Elijah's journey just yet. He goes, you're in the desert, and I think you need to address that. You need to deal with your body. You probably need to get some help. You probably need to see a doctor. And you probably need to realize that it's going to get worse before it gets better. And he was right. The thing about this phrase, we're one good conversation away, that feeling doesn't stop when you leave the job, when you leave the ministry. I was haunted by that ministry for years. I still felt like, years after I'd left the staff, after the lead pastor had been let go, that the church itself was still one good conversation away from getting back to the place that I loved, the place that I had committed my entire life to. Believing that one good conversation could restore the feeling that meant so much to me when I was there. We make a lot these days, and I attend a lot to the deconstruction conversations that are happening in the church right now, especially with evangelicals who are going through deconstruction. And one of the things you hear a lot of criticism of is criticism of the mountaintop experiences. If you grew up an evangelical, you grew up going to church camps, going to revivals, going to Christian concerts, going to whatever, you know exactly what this is. These intense emotional encounters with God and with other Christians that were a part and parcel of that life. A couple of years ago, Elevation Worship put out this song, and yes, I am going to reference Stephen Furtick's church at Mockingbird. I'm going to do so uncynically and positively. They put out this song called Old Church Basement, and the song is about this feeling of remembering these times, these places where our encounters with God were fresh and powerful. Talking about how life and faith can get complicated as we get older, the song looks back on these days with about 30 teenagers in an old church basement when all we needed was an old hallelujah and a new melody. And look, I am very cynical. I've spent a lot of time looking at the dark side of evangelicalism. But I'm telling you, when I heard this song, I lost it because I knew exactly what he was talking about. That old hallelujah and that new melody, that was the world that I lived in for so long, and it meant everything to me. A couple of years ago, I was recording a podcast with some folks, some friends of mine. It ended up not airing because the guy forgot to press record, but it was a great conversation. And there was a moment that I'll never forget because it kind of led to the book that I wrote about all of this a little while later. They were talking about these mountaintop experiences and how they kind of malformed their Christianity and it set the wrong kind of expectations. And I found myself saying something that I was really surprised by. I wasn't prepared to talk about it. And I go, no, I don't think that's right. In fact, I think when we look at the Gospels, like there's a literal mountaintop experience right at the center of the Gospels. And I don't think it's there cynically. I don't think it's there as a warning to not get too emotional about our attachment to our faith. They looked at me funny for a second. I'd kind of killed the mood, and I started talking about this story, the story of the transfiguration of Jesus. Peter, James, and John, they go up Mount Tabor one day with him, and when they get to the top, Jesus starts glowing. He glows. It tells us he's bleach white. He's so white, almost blinding white. And, you know, preachers, we love to kind of crap from great heights on Peter. It's like, oh, Peter, he's the reactionary one, and he's the one to draw the sword, and he's the one who's always demanding more for himself. But what I actually think Peter is in that story is he's the childlike one. Dallas Willard once said, children are wonderful because they can't hide. And when God says, be like a child, that's what he's talking about. Be unabashed. Peter's unabashed. He has no filter. But we're probably all feeling, we would probably all feel and think what he feels and thinks if we were in his place. And so in that moment, on that mountain, this glory manifests, and suddenly Moses and Elijah, he's back, Elijah is there standing next to him. And his response is beautiful. All the different translations kind of get at different nuances of it, but he essentially says, Master, this is a great moment. Shall I build shelters for us? And I love, like, the King James Version says tabernacles, right? Like, he knows it's this holy ground. He knows something beautiful is happening. And what I think when I read it, what I think he's saying is it's like a lover's pledge. Man, I wish we could just stay here forever. I want this moment to last. Can we just stay here? And I don't think we have to be cynical about those moments in our lives that meant that to us, because again, we've all had them. If I close my eyes, I can find myself back in those moments, even now. One of them happened in Bloomington, Indiana, at this studio called The White Ark. Like I said, I was involved in the music at our church, and it meant the world to me. And one of the most fun projects we did, we went to this place, The White Ark. It's a studio owned by a guy named Paul Mahern, this legendary producer. And we recorded this entire record on a 2-inch tape machine. And it was like midnight. We'd been there all day working on some things. This old Studer is rolling in the corner. My friend Dave is at the piano. He's playing this piano that, if you know the Over the Rhine, Ohio record, it's the Over the Rhine, Ohio record piano. And we're gathered around it, and we're singing this Isaac Watts song called Early My God. You can go on Spotify and hear this. You'll hear it, and you'll hear, like, the first verse is kind of stilted. It doesn't quite work. It's almost bad. Like, we probably should have recorded it, except we were recording to tape. And the reason we didn't re-record it is because there's something that happens on the second verse, and I don't know how to explain it. But it just happens. The song comes alive. And it was beautiful, and we felt it in that moment. We all kind of looked at each other. I remember Paul looking at me and just mouthing, wow, when we were done. It's an Isaac Watts hymn. The lyric says, not life itself with all her joys will tempt my spirit move. My maker and my helping hand, all I need is you. And I remember thinking, this is holy ground. Maybe I should take my shoes off. There are dozens of these moments, though. For me, they're mostly marked by music. I remember this Sunday morning, this Easter Sunday, where I got this idea to do Don Francisco's He's Alive. People thought I was kind of nuts, because it's this, like, you know, old CCM thing. But my friend Meg Schaefer, sang it. And she about sang the paint off the walls. And I'm telling you, when she got to the final choruses of that song, singing, he's alive, he's alive, he's alive, and I'm forgiven, heaven's gates are open wide, the room just exploded. Because people believed it. They knew she was telling the truth. These were my mountaintops. The places where the glory of God showed up with such a dazzling and undeniable brightness that even a decade later, I could lose my composure talking about them. So then what do I do in the aftermath? What do I do with my own inner voice that, like Peter says, can we just stay here? Practically speaking, what I might have done, though you wouldn't have gotten through to me, is to keep reading. Because the gospel writers know what they're doing. And if you keep reading that story where in the book of Matthew, where they come down the mountain, two things happen immediately after the transfiguration. One is that Jesus reminds them, by the way, we're headed to Jerusalem and I'm going to die. And the next thing that is, they encounter a child who his entire life has been having seizures and has thrown himself into the fire. So you can just imagine this child scarred by years and years of burns, kind of an image of walking death. And Jesus heals this child. The warnings were there, that the mountaintop wasn't everything, that there's a shadow to all of this life. But we often didn't pay attention. You fast forward a few months in the life of Jesus, and he's in Jerusalem. The triumphal entry happens. The disciples are like us. They're caught up in the moments. They're caught up in the dream. They're paying attention to the glory. They're not paying attention to the warnings about death. They're not paying attention to the shadows. So even though if you really sort of look at the triumphal entry, it's kind of a farce. It's kind of a parody. And Jesus is weeping as they walk into the city. They don't understand what's coming. The Last Supper happens. And they head to Gethsemane. And when they get to Gethsemane, Jesus knows that the crucifixion is coming. And he asks these friends, he says, "Can you just stay awake with me while I pray?" And they're like, "Sure, Jesus, of course." And they fall right to sleep. And when they fall to sleep, these lonely people wonder what it was all about. The disciples have spent that week fighting for the seat on the right and the left of Jesus, fighting for glory. And when he asks for this moment, when he asks for help, they couldn't be there for him. They couldn't enter his suffering with him. And so Jesus has this incredibly lonely night before his death. We live now in this milieu of loneliness, and I mentioned it earlier, this idea that these church movements, like so much of our world right now, they're defined by this loneliness. Mars Hill, Hillsong, these movements, they draw lonely people, and they give them meaning, they give them a story, they give them a dream, and they tell them that they're not alone. And when they fall apart, these lonely people wonder what it was all about. And often, instead of blaming the ideological movement, who do they blame? They blame the faith. They blame God. They blame Jesus. And I think Gethsemane is such a perfect story to counter that, because in Gethsemane, what we see is, no. Jesus actually knows the loneliness that you've experienced. And Jesus, too, was abandoned in the midst of it. Mako Fujimura, one time we were in Gethsemane, and he started talking about this, and he goes, "What I always think about when I come here is that he was alone so that you and I would never have to be." God sends an angel to minister to him like he did to Elijah. And then came the sound of soldiers' feet. Peter wakes. He thinks it's go time. He thinks the dream is, his dream is about to be fulfilled. The war is coming. They're going to overthrow the Romans. He's going to get this great seat next to Jesus in the coming kingdom. And he draws his sword, and he cuts the ear off of one of the high priest's servants. And Jesus tells him, "Put the sword away," and he heals the ear. And everything in Peter's world begins to fall apart right at that moment. He realizes he doesn't understand the story that he's a part of. That Jesus is not going to fulfill this dream, fulfill this wish. And he walks Jesus get marched away into the night. One of the things that I think is so fascinating that takes place that night is these denials. And I grew up, Columbine came just after my high school years. But even before Columbine, I was growing up in a moment where there was kind of an obsession over this idea of how are we, what would you do if your life was on the line for your faith? If somebody puts a gun in your face and says, "Do you believe in God?" What would you say? And you would always hear the story of Peter and Peter's denials kind of framed as one of the ways to think about that moment. Are you going to be like Peter? Are you going to deny that you don't know Jesus? Are you going to be bold and be willing to suffer or to die for your faith? And I got to say that on the other side of the journey that I've been on, I think that's the exact wrong reading of what's going on with Peter that night. Because I think what's actually happening with Peter in that moment is that he's telling the truth. When someone says to him, "Hey, weren't you with that man?" And he responds and he goes, "I don't even know him." There's an element, there's a way in which we can understand that Peter was telling the truth. Because the Jesus that he knew The Jesus that was the Jesus of the story that he'd been telling himself for 3 years was a Jesus who was going to lead a revolution, was a Jesus who was going to march into Jerusalem and overthrow the Romans and purify the city, like Elijah conquering the prophets of Baal. But instead, there's this guy, and he's getting whipped, and he's getting beaten and humiliated. And he goes, I don't even know this guy. And I think he was telling the truth. He didn't know that man. Over these years, I spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours on the therapist's couch trying to process all of this. And every session basically ended the same. I would talk and I'd say, this is what I'm going through, this is what I'm trying to wrap my head around. And the therapist would nod, and this was not one therapist. I went through like 3 or 4 of them because I kept getting the same answer and I didn't like the answer, it wasn't helpful. They would end and they would say, yeah, I think you need to learn to grieve. And so finally, several years into this, I respond to one of them and I go, look, I don't know what the hell that means. You've been saying that for like 1.5 years. What does that mean? I'm just supposed to sit here and feel sad? And then my dad died, suddenly, unexpectedly in 2021. He woke up one day, he was kind of disoriented, and it's a long story. He was back and forth to some different doctors and hospitals. Finally, after about 6 weeks, they realized that he had cancer, and a week after the cancer diagnosis, he was gone. And about a month after the funeral, I went to get a haircut, and I remember I was sitting in this barber chair in this barbershop, and I saw the blue bottle of Barbicide on the counter. And I remembered this moment from Curb Your Enthusiasm where Larry is just disgusted because someone had been sticking a pen in their ear. And he's talking, this is the season where there's the Seinfeld reunion, he's talking to Jerry Seinfeld about it. And Jerry says, you know, I like to keep my pens in Barbicide just to keep them nice and pure. And Larry says, well, what is Barbicide anyway? He goes, is that for barbers to commit suicide? He's like, yeah. He's like, when they're done, they just, you know, take everything out of there and they drink it, they commit Barbicide. So I'm sitting there in this chair and I think of that joke and I start kind of laughing to myself thinking of that joke. And my dad, who was an obsessive Seinfeld fan, I thought, oh, I should text Dad. And the quiet laughing turned into really embarrassing public sobbing, right? And this is like a hipster barbershop in Louisville with like cool tattooed barbers and everything. And the barber, this girl Jessie, is cutting my hair and she's telling this kind of wild story about fishing for sharks. And so she's just talking, and all of a sudden I'm just crying uncontrollably. And she starts to look at me funny, and she kind of steps back, and the clippers are going, and she goes, you okay? And I just blurt out, my dad died a month ago. And she goes, oh, me too, about 3 months ago. She goes, it never gets better. It always hurts. And it was exactly what I needed to hear. It was the kindest thing that anyone had said to me that month. It doesn't get better. It always hurts. And I walked out of there, and I remember standing outside the barbershop and going, oh, that's what grief is. Grief is going, it's over. He's not on the other end of the phone. And eventually I made the connection, and I realized, oh, grief is looking back on the mountaintop, on the glorious stuff, on all those stories, those things that I loved. And it's not saying that was all garbage, it was all a lie, it was all performative, it was all in service of a narcissist. It's going, man, that was beautiful. But it ended. But it ended. I'm not one conversation away. And I have to live with that. And without dragging this on any further and getting the hook from Dave here in a moment, I'll say this. What's beautiful in Peter's story is that he goes through this moment of devastation. And then after several days, he says, you know what, guys, I'm going fishing. The tomb is empty. We don't know what the heck is going on. But you know what I do know? I know fishing. I'm going fishing. And he goes to Galilee. And there's this incredible moment where after a whole night of fishing, they don't find anything. And they're on their way back. And Jesus appears on the shoreline. And he tells them to cast on the other side of the boat. And they do it. And we know what happens. The net is full. And it's this kind of liturgical thing. It's a return, because in the book of Luke, that's the first miracle we see Jesus perform. And so Peter knows immediately that it's Jesus. And what I love about what happens is that when he has that recognition, he dives into the water and swims to shore. Now, I know that I'm reading into the text when I say this, but I'm going to do it anyway. He dives in. This is the same Peter who tried to walk on water. And I just can't get over the idea that maybe there's something to that. That maybe this guy who had this audacity all through the life and ministry of Jesus, he doesn't have that same audacity. He just wants to be with Jesus. And he dives to that shore, and they have this incredible reconciling conversation. And in that, he's no longer worried about which seat he's going to have on which side of Jesus when he enters his kingdom. And in fact, when Jesus tells him, you're going to die like I did, you're going to follow in my footsteps, you're going to be taken places you don't want to go and suffer things you don't want to deal with, he's okay with it. He's a little worried about, like, so I have to do that? What about John? But none of us are perfect. Point being that his encounter with Gethsemane, I don't think it took anything away from Mount Tabor. And we know that because when he wrote in his epistles much later, he was still celebrating the beauty and the glory of Mount Tabor. It adds a nuance. Gethsemane certainly transforms it, but it doesn't diminish it. So yes, the death of your dreams, it is a kind of a gift. Like grief, the death of my dreams was, understanding the death of my dreams was kind of the last gift my father gave me. It was the last gift that Jesus gave Peter in his earthly ministry. Not because the dream wasn't beautiful, and certainly not because it was a lie, but because that dream, that glory on whatever your Mount Tabor might have been, is made more beautiful in the shadow of suffering and the cross. And when we see it that way, we don't need to walk on water anymore. Our grandiosity can be put to death. We're not going to change the world. We're probably not going to reach the city. But we're also not going to be alone, ever. And that, we discover, is much better than any of those dreams. Thanks.